Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Before I start, if you have any confusion about that gospel reading, Debbie Thomas has unraveled it for you in her essay on Journey with Jesus. I am staying away from that today. Having the patience of Job. Does that sound familiar? It's a colloquial saying that's lost some traction in our times of on-demand, instant delivery, 24/7 everything, and a Silicon Valley ethos of move fast and break things. Mark Zuckerberg said that. He might be reflecting on that right now. This saying was inspired by the story of the blameless and upright character we met in our first lectionary reading from Job 19. Now, this book, written in a completely unique mix of Aramaic and ancient Hebrew, maybe by Moses, maybe not, later sanitized by the Greeks in their translation, the Septuagint, to emphasize patience over dissidence, is also described as the strangest book in the Bible, and is more a legend or a poem belonging in a body of text written specifically to challenge the traditional thinking of the day. A body of text known as wisdom literature. And the startling setup of the Job story confirms the strangeness. One day, some angels are visiting God, and Satan tags along. Satan has been roaming the earth doing whatever Satan does, perhaps looking for the next vulnerable victim. And God asks Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Now, what is God doing here? Is he showcasing Job, hoping Satan will take some tips and reform? Is he goading Satan? In any case, Satan raises an eyebrow and challenges God, saying, "Well, of course Job is faithful to you. You've given Job everything a man could want. Enormous wealth, his health, a big family, power, prestige, and fame. Let's see what would happen if all that was taken away." And God responds, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Job is still God's man, and following God has never been for the faint of heart." Now we fast forward to the first half of Job 19. And we find Job has crossed the socioeconomic divide from the 1% to the majority world. He's homeless, dependent, and desperately ill. His 10 children have been taken from him and are now dead. He's the poorest of the poor. His displaced and grief-stricken wife has rejected him. He's held suspect by his extended family, reviled by all, even the children in the street, and is being actively and relentlessly bullied by his friends, who in the worldview and the tradition of that day blame Job for all that's happened. He must have really screwed up and done some serious sinning to bring all this on. That's how it works. And God seems silent. Now, at first blush, I want to round up Job's wife, family, and friends and give them a good talking to. But imagine what they've witnessed. How terrifying. This man, revered for very good reason, is now toxic. The certainty that had been afforded Job by his wealth, class, privilege, and a very special place in the world as a beacon of goodness has disappeared. And with this, the tenets of a cherished and organizing worldview are crumbling. If this could happen to Job, what's going to happen to them? To us? Perhaps we look around at our world and we can relate. Fear distorts us. Satan knew this. And the best way to bring Job down and disrupt God's way throughout that world was to make everyone afraid. But then, a patient Job starts raising an eyebrow. First at his friends, calling out and lamenting their endless waves of abuses, and then when they threaten to layer it on, he finally says, "Time out. Tell it to God. He's the one behind all this. He's the one who dragged me into this mess." And Job then dares to call out his grievances against God, too. What's Job doing? Is he somehow goading God? Now, Job could have gone a lot of ways at this point. He could have said, "Forget God, because God has forgotten me." He could have said, "Look at my friends and family, those people of God. What hypocrites! This organized religion, it's a total bunch of bunk, and I don't want to have anything to do with it." He could have said, "My life has just gotten too hard. I'm done." But he doesn't. Despite his present circumstances and all the questions and doubts that must have been hounding him in his changing world, Job, God's man, raises a holy fist of faith and declares, "I know God lives. Oh, that my words were written down. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and with lead they were engraved on a rock forever. For I know my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold and not another." In this passage, further immortalized in Handel's Messiah, Job takes a stand saying, "Hey God, be God." Not just for himself, but as a righteous reminder to God that God must live up to God's self and God's covenant always. How do we know this? Because Job's not willing to do business as usual and have his words written down on any old piece of legal papyrus, something that can disintegrate and disappear. But hearkening the Ten Commandments, he wants it chiseled by an iron pen on a rock that can last forever for all of us. So when Job says, "For I know my Redeemer lives," it isn't some passive song of adulation. It's a worshipful declaration of Job's conviction that the living God of all, life giver and promise maker, will come through as life sustainer and promise keeper, because God must be God. Maybe not in Job's time, maybe not in ours, nor in traditional ways, but in God's time and in God's way. Now, the Greeks may have tried to tame Job, but here in this passage, it simply can't be done. And nor do we see a tame David holding back his grievances and deepest desires in Psalm 17. We are God's gritty and redeemed people. And as such, we have biblical permission to go to God with all of who we are, as we are. Our anger, our fears, our depression, our tears, our questions and doubts, our hopes and desires. Drawing near and crying out, why, is as important and intimate an act of worship as expressing our gratitude is. We cannot forget that Jesus, God's own Son, called out, my God, why have you forsaken me? This passage from Job has become even more meaningful to me because I realized it had inspired a Bill Gaither song that my mom and dad would sing at our upright piano in the living room. And the chorus goes, because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future. My life is worth the living just because he lives. Anyone remember that song? Yeah, okay. I can still hear my dad's powerful crescendo as he not just sang but willed that chorus to be true. Because like many here, my mom and dad's life was not easy. Cancers, car accidents, brain injuries, job loss, a mentally ill child. It's the stuff of our lives. And then they'd raise their fists of faith and sing with a wholehearted and unfathomable courage, conviction, and joy. During dark days, when we are shaken in mind or alarmed, when lawlessness seems to rule the land, and we see leaders opposing truth and exalting themselves as gods and objects of worship, when suffering stops at our own doorsteps, we can join Job, our ancients, my parents, and each other in lament. Absolutely. And then raise our fists of faith in the hope and courage that comes from the conviction that the living God of all, life giver and promise maker, will come through as life sustainer and promise keeper, because we know God lives.